The candlelight inside Whitford House trembled as if even the flames knew something was about to break. Eleanor Waverly stood near the gilded edge of the ballroom, a glass of lemonade warming in her glove, her heart a foolish, hopeful thing she had long stopped trusting. She was 22, the daughter of a baronet now 3 years dead, and her dress was the same ivory silk she had worn to half a dozen gatherings, carefully retrimmed with new ribbons so no one would notice. She had always been good at not being noticed. Except tonight. Tonight she had watched the Duke of Ashworth from the moment he entered the room, dark-haired and solemn, cutting through the crowd like a figure from a history she was not supposed to touch. He had never spoken to her directly, but his name lived in every whispered corner of the ton. Cold, they called him. Disciplined. A man carved from winter. Eleanor had spent 2 seasons imagining what it might feel like to step inside that winter and find something warm. She did not mean to draw close to him. She only wanted to pass near enough to hear his voice, a small indulgence before returning to her aunt's side and the long, quiet carriage ride home. The refreshment table stood between them, and Lord Pemberton, florid and careless, leaned toward the Duke with a laugh that carried too far. "Ashworth, you must dance at least once, or the matrons will invent a tragedy. Look around, surely some maiden deserves your indifference." Pemberton gestured loosely, and his hand swept past Eleanor. "There's that Waverly girl. Pretty enough, I grant you, but no fortune. Still, a man might take pity. One dance wouldn't kill you." Eleanor's fingers tightened on her glass. The noise of the room seemed to drop, leaving only the beat of her own blood. She should move. She could not move. The Duke's reply came low and smooth, without hesitation, without cruelty in its tone, but with a precision that flayed her open. "I have no interest in insipid wallflowers who lack the sense to know their place. Pity is a poor reason to dance, and I am not a charitable institution." A laugh bubbled from someone nearby. Eleanor did not see who. She only felt the heat climb her throat and bloom across her cheeks, a scorching public brand. She turned, desperate to retreat, but her slipper caught on the hem of her gown. The stumble was small, but it was enough. The Duke of Ashworth looked at her. Their eyes met for the first time, and she saw in his face not cruelty, not satisfaction, only a quiet, absolute recognition that he had been overheard and that it did not matter. He inclined his head, the barest courtesy, and turned back to Pemberton as if she were already gone. Eleanor walked. She did not run. Running would have confirmed everything. She set her glass down on a passing tray and moved through the crowd with a smile fixed so tightly it felt like bone. The terrace doors opened under her hand, and the cold March air seized her, but she did not stop until she reached the stone balustrade, far from the light, far from the music, where the night pressed against her like a bruise. She gripped the cold stone and let the tears come, silent and hot, because she could not stop them. For 3 years she had been careful, polite, unobtrusive. She had never asked for admiration, only to escape humiliation. And yet in the span of a heartbeat, the most admired man in England had reduced her to nothing with 5 indifferent words. She was a wallflower, insipid, lacking sense. The words repeated, carving themselves deeper. But underneath the shame, something else stirred, fragile and furious. She would not be this again. She would not let his voice become the voice in her own head. Eleanor pressed her palm against her chest and breathed until the tears stopped. When she lifted her face, the stars were cold and clean and entirely indifferent, and that felt, in a strange way, like permission. She would learn to be indifferent, too. Inside the ballroom, the Duke of Ashworth, Alexander Montclair, accepted a glass of wine and did not think of the girl in ivory silk. Not consciously. But as the evening wore on, he found himself glancing toward the terrace doors, where a figure had slipped into darkness and never returned. Something about the way she had looked at him, not anger, not pleading, but a quiet, crumbling grief, pricked at the edge of his attention. He dismissed it. He was not a man given to sentiment. Yet later in his carriage, when the city was silent and the wheels rumbled over cobblestones, he saw her eyes again, dark and drowning. It unsettled him. He did not know why. 4 weeks later, Eleanor accompanied her aunt, Mrs. Theodora Hale, to a garden luncheon at Harrow Grange, a sprawling stone estate draped in early wisteria. The invitation had arrived with pointed warmth from the Duchess of Harrow herself, a woman who collected people like porcelain and was not easily refused. Aliner went because refusing would have drawn attention, and attention was the last thing she wanted. She had spent the intervening weeks rebuilding herself in silence, waking early to read history and philosophy, practicing a composure that felt, at first, like wearing borrowed armor. She was no longer the girl who trembled at a man's careless words. She was learning to be still. The garden was a tapestry of lilac and green, and Aliner moved through it with quiet grace, accepting a cup of tea, laughing gently at a dowager's story about her pugs. She felt the weight of her own performance, but it was a weight she chose. Then she saw him. The Duke of Ashworth stood near a fountain, speaking with their hostess, his dark coat cutting a sharp line against the pastel afternoon. Aliner's heart gave a single, treacherous lurch. She looked away before he could catch her eye and drifted toward a cluster of young ladies discussing watercolors. She did not need to be near him. She did not wish to be. But the Duke had already seen her. He had noticed her the moment she arrived, a figure in pale blue walking like a woman who had learned to carry her own sky. She did not glance at him, did not blush or angle herself into his path. She was simply absent from his orbit. It was disorienting. At the Whitford ball, she had been all soft, wounded visibility. Now she was a closed door. He found himself cataloging the change, the steadiness of her hands, the careful way she listened to others, the intelligence that flickered in her eyes when someone mentioned a recent parliamentary debate. She did not speak loudly, but when she did, her words were precise and unexpectedly sharp, drawing startled laughter from an old Viscount. The rain came without warning, a sudden spring downpour that sent guests hurrying toward the house. Aliner, caught near the rose arbor, ducked into the nearest open door and found herself in a small, amber-lit library, the smell of leather and paper rising around her. She was shaking droplets from her sleeves when the door opened again and the Duke of Ashworth stepped inside, his hair damp, his presence instantly filling the room. He stopped when he saw her. She straightened. For a long moment, neither spoke. The rain hammered the windows. "I apologize," he said, his voice quieter than she remembered. "I did not realize the room was occupied." "It is large enough for two," Aliner replied, her tone perfectly even. She did not curtsy. She simply returned her gaze to the bookshelf, though every nerve in her body was alive. He did not leave. Instead, he moved toward the opposite shelf, scanning titles with an attention she suspected was feigned. "You are Miss Waverley." "Yes," she did not elaborate. The silence stretched. He pulled a volume from the shelf and turned it over in his hands. "I believe I owe you an apology. The last time we were in the same room, I said something inexcusable." Aliner's fingers paused on a leather spine. She had not expected this. She turned her head slightly. "You said something careless, Your Grace. There is a difference. I do not hold you responsible for my feelings, nor do I require your apology. That incident is behind me." The Duke set the book down. Her composure was extraordinary. He had seen grown men crumble under less. "You are very gracious." "No," she said, and for the first time her voice held a hint of real steel. "I am simply no longer in the habit of giving people power over my peace." She picked up a book of poetry and walked toward the door. "The rain is stopping. Excuse me." She left him standing in the library, the ghost of her words hanging in the air. Alexander Montclair stared at the closed door and felt something shift beneath his ribs, something he had no name for. He had been dismissed with more elegance than anyone had ever dared, and instead of offense, he felt a bewildering, hungry curiosity. Who was she, this woman who had been so wounded and now stood so straight? He wanted to know. He wanted to hear her speak again. The thought followed him through the rest of the day, an unfamiliar ache that would not quiet. That night, Aliner lay in her narrow bed and stared at the ceiling. She had been calm, she had been strong, but his voice, low and unexpectedly sincere, had brushed against the bruised place inside her and left it throbbing. She had not forgiven him. She could not. And yet, when she closed her eyes, she saw not the cold face from the ballroom but the man in the library, unsure for the first time. It terrified her how much she wanted to see that man again. 3 weeks later, an invitation arrived on thick ivory paper, embossed with the Ashworth crest. The Duke of Ashworth requested the pleasure of Miss Waverley's company at a week-long house party at Ashworth Hall, a gathering to celebrate the start of the hunting season. Eleanor's aunt nearly dropped her teacup. "This is extraordinary. Ashworth never entertained so personally. You must go." Eleanor wanted to refuse. The thought of stepping into his home, surrounded by his world, made her stomach tighten. But refusal would spark more gossip than attendance, and some quiet, stubborn part of her wanted to prove that she could walk his halls without falling apart. She accepted with a letter so formal it felt like armor. Ashworth Hall rose from the Derbyshire countryside like something from a dream, gray stone, ivy-laced, with windows that caught the low autumn sun. Eleanor arrived in a hired carriage, her aunt chattering beside her, her own heart a drum in her throat. The great hall was filled with guests, lords and ladies who greeted her with the practiced warmth of people who had already decided she was nobody important. She smiled, she nodded. She survived dinner seating that placed her far from the Duke but directly across from Lady Beatrice Huxley, a woman whose beauty was as sharp as her tongue. "What a charming gown, Miss Waverley," Lady Beatrice said, her voice carrying sweet poison. "I do admire someone who can make so little stretch so far. It must be exhausting, always reinventing the same fabric." The table's laughter was a low ripple. Eleanor's spoon paused above her soup, and she felt the familiar burn of humiliation rising. But before she could respond, the Duke's voice cut through from the head of the table. "Resourcefulness is an undervalued virtue, Lady Beatrice. Not everyone inherits beauty and wit in equal measure. Some must cultivate the latter through far more effort." The words landed like a blade wrapped in silk. Lady Beatrice flushed scarlet. Eleanor looked up, startled, and found the Duke's gray eyes resting on her with something she could not decipher. Not warmth, exactly, but a deliberate, steady acknowledgement. He had defended her, publicly. The conversation shifted, but Eleanor could not eat. Every nerve in her body was tuned to the man at the far end of the table, who now seemed determined to ignore his own act of chivalry. The following afternoon, she walked alone in the walled winter garden, a place of sculpted evergreens and stone benches cold with frost. The air was thin and sharp, and she was grateful for the solitude. She heard footsteps behind her and turned. The Duke approached, his great coat dark against the pale hedges. "May I walk with you?" She hesitated, then inclined her head. They moved side by side in silence, and she was acutely aware of his height, the way his hands remained clasped behind his back, the quiet sound of his breathing. "Why did you come?" he asked at last. "After what I said that night, I did not expect you to accept my invitation." Eleanor stopped beside a stone urn filled with frozen soil. "Because I needed to know that I could stand in the same room as you and not break," she said honestly. "I am tired of being shaped by other people's words, Your Grace. I came to take something back for myself." He was silent, and when she looked at him, his expression was unreadable but deeply attentive, as if she were a language he was only beginning to learn. "You are not what I assumed," he said. "No," she replied softly, "I am not." That evening, the guests gathered in the music room. Eleanor declined to play the pianoforte, pleading a headache, but she watched as the Duke's younger brother, Lord Henry Montclair, coaxed her into a game of chess by the fire. Henry was warm where his brother was cool, his laughter easy, his attention flattering. Eleanor found herself smiling, genuinely smiling, and she did not notice the Duke standing near the doorway, his gaze fixed on the two of them with a stillness that was not calm at all. His jaw tightened. His fingers curled against his glass, watching her laugh with another man, watching her lean slightly toward the chessboard, something dark and possessive unfurled in his chest, something that felt terrifyingly like jealousy. He did not want to share the sound of her laugh. He did not want to share anything. The realization shook him so deeply that he left the room without a word. The scandal arrived on the third morning, carried on the breath of a Viscountess who had always loved destruction. Elinor, she whispered to a circle of eager listeners, had been secretly promised to a tradesman in Manchester, a man who had made his fortune in cotton and had no place in polite society. The rumor was absurd, but it spread like ink through water. By luncheon, Elinor felt the weight of sideways glances and sudden silences. She held herself very still, refusing to crumble, but inside she was a child again, waiting for the laughter to start. The Duke of Ashworth heard the rumor from his valet and went very, very still. Then he dressed with deliberate care, walked into the drawing room where the gossip was thickest, and spoke into the hush like a man accustomed to commanding armies. "I am disappointed to discover that some among my guests consider slander a form of entertainment." His voice was ice, but beneath it ran a current of barely controlled anger. "Miss Waverley's character is beyond reproach. I have come to know her, and I assure you, no such engagement exists. I expect this rumor to die before the next meal, or those who perpetuate it will find their invitations to Ashworth Hall permanently revoked." Silence, absolute, ringing silence. Elinor, seated near the window, felt the world tilt. He had not only defended her, he had claimed intimate knowledge of her character. In doing so, he had tied his own reputation to hers, and in the arithmetic of the ton, that was a declaration of far more than courtesy. He came to her afterward, when the guests had dispersed into smaller groups, and asked her to walk with him on the east terrace. The afternoon light was pale gold, and she was trembling slightly, not from cold. "You did not have to do that," she said, her voice strained. "You have put yourself at risk." "I did it because it was true, and because I could not bear to see you wounded again by my silence." He stopped and faced her, and for the first time his composure cracked just slightly around the eyes. "What I said at the Whitford ball was unforgivable. I have regretted it every day since. I was arrogant and I was blind and I hurt you without a thought. I am asking you, not for forgiveness, but for the chance to prove that I am not that man any longer." Elinor looked at him, this stoic, powerful man whose voice now held a tremor she had never imagined. Something inside her softened, but something else, the part that had learned to protect herself, held firm. "You were cruel," she said quietly, "and I have worked very hard to stop needing the approval of men like you. I cannot give you absolution simply because you ask prettily now. It has to mean more than that." She left him on the terrace, his hand half raised as if to reach for her. Alexander stood alone as the sun sank lower, the chill seeping through his coat and her words repeated in his mind like a sentence. He had been arrogant. He had been blind. And now the one woman who had begun to make him feel human again was walking away, and he had no idea if she would ever turn back. The fear that gripped him was absolute. He whispered her name into the twilight, and it sounded like a prayer. The remaining days of the house party were a study in quiet torment. Elinor maintained a careful distance, and the Duke respected it, but his attention was a constant, gentle pressure. A book he thought she might enjoy left outside her door, a footman sent to stoke her fire before she retired, his presence always at the edge of her vision, watchful and restrained. She felt herself softening against her will, and it frightened her. On the sixth morning, a letter arrived for Elinor. It was from Mr. Henry Fletcher, a childhood friend who had made a comfortable fortune in shipping and who had, for years, harbored a steady, unromantic affection for her. He wrote to offer her marriage, a practical arrangement that would give her security, a home, and freedom from the precarious charity of relatives. He was a good man. She could learn to be content. She sat in the window seat, the letter in her lap, and wept not from joy or sorrow but from exhaustion. Here was an escape, a door she could walk through and never again have to fight for her place in a world that did not want her. The Duke's shadow loomed too large, too consuming. She could not trust it. She could not trust herself. Alexander found her there, the tear tracks still visible on her cheeks, the letter crumpled in her hand. Something inside him broke open. He crossed the room without thought for propriety and knelt before her, a duke on his knees before a baronet's daughter, and his voice was raw. "Eleanor, tell me what that letter says, because I cannot bear the look in your eyes." She stared at him, shocked. "It is a marriage proposal, a kind one, a safe one." His face whitened. He took her hand before she could pull away. "Do not accept it." The words were rough, desperate. "I know I have no right to ask anything of you. I have been cold and careless and proud, but you have undone me. I think of you every moment. I cannot eat, I cannot sleep, I cannot breathe without you in the room. I love you. I love you, and I am terrified you will slip through my fingers because I do not deserve you. Please, do not leave." The confession hung in the air, huge and shattering. Eleanor's heart pounded so hard she felt dizzy. She had imagined hearing those words 1,000 times, but never like this, never with this broken, magnificent man kneeling at her feet. And yet the fear was still there. "Love can be a weapon," she whispered. "I have been cut by it before." He did not argue. He only bowed his head and pressed his forehead to her knuckles, a gesture of such profound surrender that her breath caught. "Then I will spend the rest of my life proving that mine is not a blade. Give me time, just time." She pulled her hand gently away and stood. "I need to think, Your Grace. I need to be sure that I am choosing, not just being swept away." She walked to the door, pausing only once. "I am leaving in the morning. I will give you my answer in London." That night, the Duke did not sleep. At dawn, he stood at his window and watched her carriage roll down the long drive, taking his heart with it into the gray morning light. The fear of losing her was a physical weight, and for the first time in his life, he understood that love was not a weakness but the only thing worth suffering for. London in early winter was a city of smoke and sharp winds, and Eleanor plunged into it with a determination that felt like survival. She returned Mr. Fletcher's letter with a careful, grateful refusal, explaining that her heart was not free to offer, and that she would not do him the dishonor of a half-love. Then she waited, not for the Duke, she told herself, but for the clarity that solitude might bring. Alexander arrived in town 3 days later. He sent no flowers, no grand gestures. Instead, he secured an invitation to a small musical evening at Lady Danforth's, where he knew Eleanor would be, and he came alone, dressed simply, his face thinner and his eyes shadowed with sleeplessness. When he saw her across the room, dressed in deep green velvet, her posture as straight as a promise, he felt his heart seize. She did not avoid him. She excused herself from a conversation and walked toward him, and they stood in a quiet alcove while a soprano sang of lost love in the next room. "You look tired," she said softly, and the gentleness in her voice nearly undid him. "I have not slept well since you left," he admitted. "I have been writing and discarding letters, rehearsing what I would say. But all of it reduces to this: I was a fool, I hurt you. I will never stop regretting it. But I love you, Eleanor. I love the way you argue with me, the way you defend people who cannot defend themselves, the way you read poetry when you think no one is watching. I love you, and I will wait forever if you need me to." She looked at him for a long, searching moment, and he let her look, holding nothing back. "I broke my engagement," she said. "Not for you, for myself. Because I realized I could not marry a man I respected but did not love just to feel safe. I had to learn that my safety comes from within, not from a ring." His breath caught, and now? "Now I need to know that you see me," she said, her voice trembling only slightly. "Not as a project to be rescued, not as a regret to be assuaged, but as a woman with her own strength. Can you love me without needing me to be weak?" "Yes," he said, and the word was a vow. "I love you because you are stronger than I ever was. You walked through fire and came out made of light. I see you, Eleanor. I see all of you." She closed her eyes and a single tear traced down her cheek. When she opened them again, she smiled. Not the practiced smile of the ballroom, but the true, unguarded smile he had only glimpsed once or twice before. "Then I think, Alexander, we have a great deal to talk about." He did not embrace her there in the crowded alcove. He simply stood beside her, and they listened to the music together, their shoulders almost touching, the silence between them filled with something vast and new. That night, he walked her to her aunt's door, and before she went inside, she turned and pressed her gloved hand briefly to his chest. "Come tomorrow," she said. "We'll begin." He stood in the cold street long after the door closed, the imprint of her hand burning through his coat, and for the first time in years, he felt hope. The next morning, Alexander arrived at the narrow townhouse in Bloomsbury carrying no gifts but his own raw honesty. Alina received him in the small parlor, her aunt having been dispatched upstairs with a strategic headache. They sat across from each other, a tea tray growing cold between them, and they talked. He told her about his childhood, a father who equated emotion with weakness, a mother who died when he was 12, leaving him to grow up inside a fortress of his own making. He had learned to fear tenderness because tenderness had always been followed by loss. Alina listened, her hands folded, and when he finished, she told him about the years after her father's death, the slow erosion of her dowry, the relatives who treated her like furniture, the night she had stood on that terrace and decided to become someone who could not be broken. "I understand now," Alexander said, his voice low, "that when I dismissed you, I was dismissing a part of myself that I had been taught to despise. You were everything I was afraid to feel." "And now," she asked. "Now I'm afraid of only one thing," he said, "losing you." He did not kneel this time. He reached across the table and took her hand, and it was the simplest, most honest gesture he had ever made. "Alina, I am asking you to marry me, not because I want to possess you, but because I want to walk beside you for the rest of my life. I want to watch you grow even stronger, and I want to be the man who cherishes that strength. I will make mistakes. I will be too quiet, too stern, too slow to speak, but I will never, ever make you feel invisible again. This I swear." Her heart was a tide, pulling her toward him. She had spent so long building walls that she had almost forgotten they could become doors. "I am not afraid of your quiet," she said. "I am afraid of losing myself in you. But I think I have finally found myself enough to share her." She squeezed his hand. "Yes, I will marry you." The joy that broke across his face was unguarded and boyish, and she laughed, a wet, surprised laugh, as he came around the table and pulled her gently into his arms. He held her as if she were made of spun glass and steel, and she let herself rest against him, the solid, steady beat of his heart beneath her ear. That evening, she walked alone in the small garden behind the townhouse, the bare branches of a cherry tree scratching the sky, and she felt the last weight of the past year slide from her shoulders. She had not chased approval. She had not begged for love. She had walked away, and in walking away, she had found both. They were married on the first day of spring at the chapel on the Ashworth estate, a small stone building covered in climbing roses that had not yet bloomed but held the promise of green. The guests were few, her aunt, his brother Henry, the Duchess of Harrow, and a scattering of true friends. Alina wore ivory silk, not the retrimmed gown of her humiliation, but a new dress, simple and elegant, and she walked down the aisle on her own feet, her head high, her eyes on the man who waited for her. Alexander watched her come toward him and his throat closed. She was radiant, not because of the dress or the flowers, but because of the quiet, luminous peace in her expression. When she reached him, he took her hand and whispered, "You are the bravest person I have ever known." The ceremony was brief and solemn, and when they emerged into the pale spring sunlight, the bells rang across the valley. The villagers had gathered at the gate, and Alina smiled at them, a real smile, the smile of a woman who had finally come home. That afternoon, they walked through the winter garden, the same garden where she had once told him she needed to stand on her own. The frost had melted, and tiny shoots of green were pushing through the dark earth. Alexander stopped beside the stone urn and turned to her, his hands cupping her face. "I used to think love was a fire that consumed," he said. "But you have taught me it is a garden. It needs patience and care, and trust that something will grow even when the ground looks dead." She leaned into his touch. "You were never dead. You were just waiting for the right season." He kissed her then, a slow, tender kiss that tasted of spring and forever, and when they parted, she was laughing softly. "We have a lifetime to fill this garden." They walked back to the house as the sun sank low, their shadows long and intertwined. Inside, the great library glowed with candlelight, and they sat together in the amber warmth, her head resting on his shoulder, a book of poetry open in her lap. The silence between them was not empty but full, full of all the words they had already said, and all the years they would have to say more. He pressed his lips to her hair. "I love you," he murmured. "I will love you until the winter garden blooms 100 times over. She closed her eyes and smiled, her hand finding his. "Then we will have a great many blooms to tend." And in the quiet, with the fire crackling and the world finally, perfectly still, they both knew they had been lost, and now, together, they were home. If you enjoyed this story, don't forget to give it a like and subscribe to the channel. Also, let us know in the comments which country you're watching from. Your support means a lot to us. Thank you for watching, and see you in the next amazing story.